out of the audience, I can look out and see all their faces. Our final speaker for this evening is Elizabeth De La Vega. A former federal prosecutor with more than 20 years' experience, Elizabeth recently published a book, United States versus George W. Bush et al. During her tenure as a prosecutor, she was a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force and chief of the San Jose branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of California. Her writing has appeared in The Nation magazine, The Los Angeles Times, and on Salon.com. And she writes regularly for TomDispatch.com. Please welcome Elizabeth De La Vega. Years in the courtroom where if you sat down while you were talking, you'd get in a lot of trouble. So I just can't do it. Sorry. Anyway, it's great to be here. And not only because there's this great crowd, but also because it took me 3 hours to drive from the airport. So I'm really happy to be here. But on the way from the airport, and I've been doing a lot of these lately, but each time I kind of think, well, why am I doing this? And I know that I'm doing this for the same reason that Ray and Dave, but more the same reason that all of you are doing it. And there are a number of reasons, but the first is that I and all of you love the Constitution.
Yeah.
A friend of mine in Minnesota. Well, that is true, of course, yes. You can't believe the Irish, by the way. A friend of mine in Minnesota is Irish, and her mother-in-law was visiting, her mother, rather, from Ireland, was visiting, and my friend Mary, of course, her name is Mary, had to admit that she wasn't a regular churchgoer, but she was driving down the street with her mother and her little daughter, Ellie, and they were going by St. Luke's, which was supposed to be their church, at least. And Ellie, with the fresh voice of a four-year-old, said, "Oh, there's our church. I wonder why we never go there." So she was busted that day. But I started to feel that way about the Constitution. Oh, there's our Constitution. I wonder why we never use it. So all of us believe in the Constitution, and I think all of us here also believe in the power of one voice. I know that's why you're all here. And I know that all of you know that your voice is just as important as Dave's or Ray's or Aaron Latata's or James G. or Rachel Corey. Everybody's voice is equally important. And the third thing is that I and all of you believe in the power of the truth and the facts. And that is what led me to write this book and how I ended up traveling around the country like this, talking to people. But I did spend over 20 years as a federal prosecutor, and when I retired in 2004, I had some time to really look at how it was that the president deceived us into going to war in Iraq. And I knew, as so many of you did, that we had been deceived, but I really didn't know how much and to what extent. And I finally had time to look at the news, which I was regrettable in some ways, but I was able to understand at least how this happened. And the nature of the debate was so ridiculous, for want of a better word, and oftentimes it came down to even people who were critics of the president would say, well, he couldn't possibly have lied about the war because he didn't know anything. He never read anything. And that was what people would say, and it frankly just blew me away, because that's not what's what the law requires in this country on the part of the president or anybody else who's in a position of authority. And as Ray was saying, just on a gut level, we all know that. We all know that it's not enough for the president to say, I just didn't know what was going on. But even more than that, I wanted to explain, just with my one voice, whatever I could add, that legally, it's a crime for the president or anybody else in a position of authority to go out and say something to people as if it's true, with certainty, when that person has no earthly idea what he's talking about. So, under the law of fraud, which has been around for hundreds of years, it's not just illegal to lie. And that makes a lot of sense, because anybody who's tried to get away with a lie knows that it's really the worst way to deceive people, because you always get caught, or you often get caught at least. It's a bad way to trick people. So the law of fraud encompasses many, many more things. And one thing it encompasses is if you go out and make a statement and you have no basis for it. That's called making a statement with reckless disregard for the truth. Makes sense, right? It also includes when you say something that's a half-truth. For example, Vice President Cheney going around saying, well, we know there were chemical weapons because Saddam Hussein's son-in-law told us, but neglecting to mention that very important other half of the story, which is that Saddam Hussein's son-in-law told us that they were destroyed. So that's a half-truth. It also applies to saying things that are deliberately misleading, even if they're not literal, even if they are literally true. For example, the 9/11 and Iraq connection that was said over and over and over again. And by the way, these principles are applied every day around the country in courtrooms to fraud cases. They're also applied to advertising. For example, Listerine. Many of you are old enough to remember this ad. The Listerine company said, kills germs on contact, and then the next sentence was, good for colds and sore throats. They had to remove that ad because it made people think colds and sore throats could be cured by Listerine. Well, do we have a higher standard for advertising of mouthwash than we have for what the president has to say? So many things about what this administration has done, and yet we all seem kind of paralyzed by it. And so when I set out to write the book, I just looked at things that were declassified, which would include the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report, the Roth-Silverman Commission report. And these reports, by the way, were pretty favorable to the administration in the first place. So I took anything that was undisputed, and I just made a timeline of what happened behind the scenes. And then I went to the White House website and all the other public sites that showed what the administration was saying all along, and I made another timeline, and I compared the two. And that's always what you do when you look at fraud. What's the difference between what people are saying and doing publicly versus what they know and say and do behind the scenes? And it was a time-consuming effort, and I've said this to other groups. My dog got involved a lot of times because I had papers all over the floor. And I don't know if he discriminated between Ari Fleischer press briefings or Scott McClellan. I lost a lot of them, and I had to reprint them. But no, he didn't get sick. What was clear to me was that what we had was a fraud that was so much worse than anything I'd ever seen in my practice as a criminal prosecutor, but so much worse than anything we've seen in this country. And of course, far, far worse than the Enron case. And who was one of the most vocal people outraged about Enron? Well, our very own President George W. Bush. But the truth is that the same law that applies to the Enron CEOs also applies to the president. Now, I'm not going to, we've already heard a lot about all the various intelligence deceits, but I just want to add one quick one for you, because one thing I think everyone should be aware of is that not everybody knows as much as you do about all these things. And you assume, because you're immersed in it, that other people know, but they really don't. So it's important to just find a few things. And I found that if you say, this is what I think, to people, that they are really persuaded more than, rather than saying, this is what you should think. So you tell me about the story about the uranium that Dave told you. You tell them about the Downing Street memos. But here's another one. It's just a quick one. And that has to do with these aluminum tubes. And of course, everybody knows that the country was not going to go to war, or approve a war, based on the possibility that there were chemical weapons in the country 8,000 miles away, or that there was anthrax 8,000 miles away. It was all about the nuclear weapons. So the one thing was the uranium. The other thing were these aluminum tubes. And when I did the research for the book, I just looked at all the documents that we had available already. And what they showed was that there were, on September 8th, when the of 2002, when various administration officials went out and said, we just recently, this is another one of those recent things, and all of you, I'm sure, are thinking about Iran and the things that we are recently finding out about Iran, even though we've known them for years as well. But the administration officials came out and said, we've recently learned from the New York Times. How did that happen? Who knew? That very morning that the Iraqis are trying to buy these aluminum tubes, and Condoleezza Rice said they're only suited for use in a centrifuge to make enriched uranium. And the other officials said pretty much the same thing, although not quite as strongly. But so at that time, based on documents that were available, and they've been available all along, we know that there were 14 different reports that had been written since starting in April of 2001, before 9/11. And the reason the reports started being written in April 2001 was because we intercepted these tubes. And the reason we were able to intercept the tubes was because the Iraqis were buying them on the open market, on the internet. I don't know if it was eBay or Craigslist or what, but not only were they buying them on the open market, they were haggling over the price. And the first report that came out, according to the findings of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, was in the President's daily brief, which would go to the President. And that was a CIA report. Now, the CIA, among the various agencies, was the one that was the main proponent of the idea that these tubes could be used in a centrifuge. But even they, in that report, alerted the President to the fact that their opinion was controversial. Their opinion was not unanimous among the agencies. So between April 2001 and September 2002, when the administration started talking about these, there were 14 reports from the Defense Investigative Agency, the Department of Energy experts, the State Department experts, various agencies, including agencies from Europe as well, and also I think Australia. Out of these 14 reports, 12 of them specifically noted that this idea, whether the tubes could be used in a centrifuge or not, was in dispute. So, looking at that just from a criminal point of view, if somebody goes out and says something is only suited for something with certainty, when the information of which they have noticed behind the scenes is that it's in dispute, it's controversial, that's fraud. So there's two possibilities. Either they just went out and said it without having a clue of what these reports said, in which case it was just an outright lie, or they knew that it was in dispute, and again, they're deceiving the public. So, but out of those 12, six of them said, not only is this in dispute, but these are the reports from the Department of Energy, our nuclear experts in Lawrence, Livermore, and Oak Ridge labs, and the Intelligence Bureau from the State Department. They said it is highly unlikely that these tubes could be used for a centrifuge. Now, and here's why. You can explain this to any friends of yours who will listen. They were 3 feet long. The Iraqis were ordering tubes that were 3 feet long. It wasn't just that they happened to have them around the palace or whatever. But in order to use them in the centrifuge, they had to be a foot long. So you could say, okay, well, we can cut them into thirds. They were coated. They were anodized. Well, they would have to have the coating removed. Otherwise, it would interact with the process. Okay, you could cut them into thirds and take off the coating. They were 3 times too thick. Well, you could machine them down. They were of an inferior metal, by the way, to the metal that we knew the Iraqis had previously. And they were 3 times too wide. You can't make them narrower. Yeah. So that was the information behind the scenes. And as one of the experts said at the time, well, you could possibly turn these into tubes that you could use in the centrifuge in the same way that maybe if you worked hard enough, you could turn a Yugo into a Cadillac. And if the Iraqis really want these tubes, we should just let them have. So what it comes down to here is that we have this massive fraud. We have the administration fabricating evidence, misleading the public about evidence, omitting evidence that they should have told us, telling half-truths, and in the end, it was a fraud much worse than Enron. And in the Enron case, the prosecutor said at the close of the case, it was not Jeffrey Skilling's Enron. It was not Ken Lay's Enron. And there's not one set of facts for inside the boardroom at Enron and another set of facts for outside the boardroom. It was the investors' Enron. It was the employees' Enron. And they were entitled to true and complete and full information about the information they needed to make decisions about their own investments. And the same is true here. It is not Vice President Cheney's United States. It is not President Bush's United States. And there's not one set of facts for inside the Oval Office and another one for outside the Oval Office. The people of the United States are entitled to true and complete and full information about the most important decision we could possibly be called upon to make, which is to invade a country 8,000 miles away that had done nothing to us, had no capability of doing anything to us. Say to you, or they say to me, why are you going around doing this? It's pointless. You're not going to get anywhere. Well, what comes to my mind is the story of Kitty Genovese. And many of you know about this story. And she was a young woman who was walking home from work in, I think, 1964. She was in Queens. And as she was walking home, she was stabbed repeatedly. And 38 of her neighbors heard or saw what was going on. They saw the crime taking place, and they didn't do anything about it. And there was a study done that showed that it wasn't because people were indifferent. It was because either they thought, if no one else is doing anything, it couldn't be that bad, or that somebody else was going to do something. But we know that this is bad. We know a crime is going on right before our very eyes, and we are the ones who have to do something. So thank you for that.